Hello and welcome to the SSP Weekly Podcast, where we dissect security and foreign policy stories from this week, and we talk about life in DC.
We are your hosts, Gareth Smythe
and Miriam Pasternak.
We are the directors of the Georgetown University Precision Guided Podcast.
And we are very excited that you tuned in today. The sound levels are good. We can get going.
Wonderful news.
Good morning, Gareth.
Miriam, good morning.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Episode 6, can you believe it?
I truly cannot. I cannot.
Okay, we have two stories today, and I think we're going to start with yours, Gareth.
Oh, excellent.
Because we had a very important diplomatic visit Monday.
We did.
What happened, Gareth?
Well, in the revolving door of Washington diplomatic visits, we had Khalid bin Salman, who is the Saudi defense minister, younger brother to the crown prince and heir apparent Mohammed bin Salman, visit Washington Monday and stay through the week to have high-level discussions with the Biden administration over a host of priorities in the Middle East, not least being the ongoing conflict between Israel and Hamas. And I wanted to, you know, a lot of coverage obviously has been happening with the attack and the subsequent response, and obviously that's an important topic, but the U.S.'s relationship with Saudi Arabia is at a really pivotal point. And I wanted to talk with someone that was an expert in these topics to kind of get a sense and level set of where the U.S. bilateral relationship with Saudi Arabia stands, mm-hmm. how is Saudi viewing the current events happening in the Middle East, mm-hmm. and what are their long-term visions and goals for where they want to go and where they want to bring the Middle East. And so I sat down with Katie Wells, who is a fellow SSP student and the associate editor for the Middle East and North Africa from the GSSR, to have that and a couple other, or have a conversation about that and a couple other points. Katie is really insightful about the priorities of Saudi Arabia, the highest being kind of economic development, which requires a certain level of stability that the Middle East has not seen in recent years. And so we kind of talk through how are they viewing the current situation and what their priorities are for the resolution of the conflict. So it's a really interesting discussion at this time given the visit, and I can't wait for folks to listen to it.
Awesome. Let's hear it.
Well, Katie Wells, thank you so much for joining us on SSP Weekly.
Hi, Gareth. It's great to be here.
So, Katie, you are the associate editor for the Middle East and North Africa at GSSR, right?
I am, indeed.
Can you tell us a little bit about that role?
Yeah, so I started that this fall, and it's going pretty well. We've got a bunch of articles coming out soon on some very relevant topics today. So I'm very excited for those to come out, and hopefully you guys will get to read them soon.
So, Katie, if you thought by taking the Middle East assignment you would have a sleepy year...
Yeah, I definitely was not expected, but you never know with the Middle East.
That is true. And actually, that's what I wanted to have you join us on today's episode to discuss. So obviously, we've covered in the past what's going on between Israel and Hamas. But one topic I wanted to dive in on was the role of Saudi Arabia, both in that conflict, but also how it sees itself in the Middle East. This is timely, because the Saudi defense minister has visited the White House on Monday for discussions with the Biden administration. Can you tell us about that visit?
Yeah, so the Saudi defense minister, Khalid bin Salman, who is the brother of the crown prince and de facto leader, Mohammed bin Salman, otherwise known as MBS informally, he was a former Saudi ambassador to the US, and he is actually the highest ranking official from Saudi Arabia to visit the U.S. under President Biden's administration.
Interesting.
Yeah, so very, very big, very important visit. And as you well know, especially in these times, it's incredibly important. So
yeah, some people have been saying that in the context of the Israeli-Hamas issue, that the timing revolved around, or one part of the timing was in regard to some of the diplomacy that the U.S. was engaged in with Saudi Arabia and Israel. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
The timing is very important. We were in a period of time where we were talking about Saudi Arabia and openly normalizing relations with Israel under a similar sort of format of the Abraham Accords, which, you know, we saw several other countries like Morocco and Bahrain do. I think this is an incredibly interesting point because we were working towards a hopeful future for Saudi and Israel to collaborate to kind of create more regional stability.
Yeah.
But at the same time, Saudi, you know, there was a Saudi and Iran deal, which was brokered by China earlier this year, which is also incredibly important. So it was definitely a shift. But I think that's more of a shift looking at Saudi's foreign policy and its domestic policy as well, which is definitely looking more kind of inwards on its economy and its push to diversify their economy predominantly before being an oil-based economy.
So can you talk to us about the significance of Saudi's normalization of relations with Israel? Because obviously, as you noted, the Abraham Accords at the end of the Trump administration was, you know, between Israel and a host of, you know, not insignificant countries in the region. So what is this kind of shining light of the potential for a Saudi-Israeli normalization?
I think for Saudi, it's definitely a shift because they're moving kind of with, I guess, this global pattern of really looking at tech, investment in sort of green energy. Mm. Tel Aviv is tech center, really, and there's so much innovations and, you know, startups going on there. Saudi were looking at it and being like, realistically, we need to collaborate to kind of improve or advance their economy and kind of creating these interconnectedness, which then provides a stability. So we're looking at it today with the US and China and looking at like how connections with the global supply chain and just like having a kind of integrated economy, it reduces the risk of full-scale conflict. And I think Saudi has definitely taken that into consideration and like looking at increasing their influence over the region through their economy rather than outright political rhetoric or anything else. And it is interesting, I mean, a few years ago, Saudi started really seeing the rivalry with the UAE, and this is a step which isn't necessarily talked about a lot, but looking at the UAE's model of, you know, starting as a country which really didn't have many options before, and then obviously making the most out of resources, and then opening up their economy to immigration, international companies, tech, development, all of that. Riyadh looked at the UAE and said, okay, right, we need to really come up with a strategy. And that's when you get Vision 2030.
Mm.
And Vision 2030 is really the priority for Saudi Arabia right now. And you can tell that within their posturing in the investment. A great example was at the G20 summit in earlier this month when India, Saudi, UAE, Israel and European states, and then obviously helped and facilitated by the US, decided to start the initial process for a India, Middle East, Europe corridor, which would be a kind of way of opening up trade from India all the way across to Europe and would, you know, subsequently benefit the Middle Eastern countries on route.
So you made a tie earlier in the discussion between the domestic priorities and the domestic politics of Saudi Arabia and its foreign policy. So can you talk a little bit more about how Vision 2030 influences Saudi foreign policy goals?
Yeah, so Vision 2030 definitely influences Saudi's posturing. Right now, they're speaking to everyone. Even today, they were on the phone to Russian officials. They've been on the phone to EU delegation. And Monday, they were at the White House. And I think that's very key because obviously they want to be seen as a peacemaker in this. I mean, they have interests in themselves, but they are, at the end of the day, an Arab country, a leading Islamic country. They do feel a sense of duty to protect Palestinian civilians in Gaza. And, you know, the contentious issue of Israel-Palestine still remains domestically. And foreign policy-wise, though, they don't want to step on anyone's toes. At the same time, they still want to be at the center. So they're trying to not take a heavy side on one thing, but just to promote peace and stability. And I think that is very important when looking at their Vision 2030, because they need other countries to, like the US, like European countries, especially the Russians and the Chinese, to sort of get on board with their Vision 2030 strategy.
So for those of us that have been watching this Israel Hamas conflict happen and then obviously escalate, I think what's been really interesting is the role of Qatar as peacemaker. How does Saudi view Qatar's role and ability to kind of bring all these different players together? And is that something that they want to be following the implementation of Vision 2030?
As you might know already, there's been issues in the past between Gulf Cooperation Council states, including Saudi Arabia and UAE, with Qatar, specifically looking at, you know, allegations of Qataris funding the Muslim Brotherhood. And I think that has been kind of interesting to see, because Qatar, they have diplomatic ties with Iran, communication with Hamas. They have Hamas leaders residing in Qatar. There's a strong relationship with the Qataris and Hamas, or at least an open channel for dialogue, which has been really helpful with the hostage situation. And the Qataris have been central to that. I mean, because of the nature of the situation, and because Saudi wants a de-escalation, and they have been actively calling, writing, trying to advocate very intensely for ceasefire and for aid to be coming to come through to Gaza, I think it shows that Saudi are really just trying to maintain regional stability. And that is a, I think, for many countries in that region. I mean, Jordan is the same, also the UAE, lots of Oman, they're really calling for de-escalation, and they're really quite concerned about, you know, spillover. And everyone's sort of aware that there have been attacks on US bases in Iraq and Syria that are housing US personnel by Islamist groups, Iraq and Syria, who are allegedly funded by Iran. And I think that's one major issue Saudi is worried about, is spillover. And because they share a border with Iraq, that's incredibly important. They share a border with Yemen. They also have a long history of cross-border conflicts with the Houthi group, which are funded also by Iran. There was a ceasefire agreed a year and a half ago, and then that fell through last October. There hasn't been any kind of major escalations in violence in Yemen, but there have still been sort of drone attacks going across border. And I think last month, it was kind of weird because there was a meeting between Houthi officials in Riyadh. So they were meeting Saudi officials to kind of come up with some sort of peace agreement, which again demonstrates Saudi's push for, okay, we'll accept that the situation isn't going to get better, so we might as well try and really enforce de-escalation, use our diplomatic tools at hand. But last month, there was actually one Bahraini service member was killed by a drone attack, which the Houthis took responsibility for. So there are still tensions at the southern border as well.
So you've spoken about the desire of Saudi Arabia to be the regional hegemon. And obviously that project butts heads with the other country that sees itself as a regional hegemon, which is Iran. You've done a really excellent job in walking us through some of the proxy battles that Iran is funding to spoil that project of Saudi Arabia. But can you speak at the higher level about the current tenor of the Saudi-Iranian relationship? I think that folks were really surprised when China announced the, I don't even know what you want to call it, a normalization agreement, a peace agreement, an agreement to begin to start a dialogue to create a further agreement between Tehran and Riyadh. So can you talk a little bit about, at that higher strategic level, what the relationship is between those two countries?
Last Monday, actually, the Iranian President Raisi met with the new Saudi Arabian ambassador to Tehran. So that's a big move. You know, they're clearly working with this agreement. They're continuing to follow through with the agreement, even though, you know, this is all on the surface. A lot of this kind of kinetic warfare, or the side of the kinetic warfare, is done through proxy groups. So in a way, that's good, because we're not in a full escalated war. But obviously, it makes things far more complicated.
So there's two more things, Katie, that I'm hoping you can help us understand with Saudi Arabia right now. And the first is on the U.S.-Saudi bilateral relationship, which has suffered since the killing of Jamal Khashoggi back in 2018. We haven't really seen Saudi-U.S. relationship improve since that time. And yet, and this has been publicly reported, one of the deals on the table in response to Saudi-Israeli normalization was going to be a U.S.-Saudi defense pact to enhance what is already a fairly strong defense relationship between the two countries. So can you talk us through why Saudi was interested in an enhanced defense partnership with the U.S. and how they see the U.S. Role in the Middle East, either kind of at a grand strategic level or at a defense level?
I'm going to start off with the defense level. The U.S., as you very well know, has world-class military equipment and military training. And I am saying that as a Brit. So I think, you know, Saudi officials, the Saudi government are fully aware of that. They are not dismissing that at all. They understand the kind of full package of what a defense pact could bring. US equipment, air defense systems, vital during that period of time when there were increased cross-border attacks with Houthi groups attacking critical infrastructure. Part of Vision 2030 is really looking at how Saudi Arabia can revolutionize their economy into a green economy. And they are pushing that. They're initially funding with the Public Investment Fund, which is the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund. But they are also looking for other forms of, you know, funding and donations. Looking to the US as a partner would be incredibly helpful for that. So they're definitely keeping that in mind. So again, back to this kind of influence through economy. I mean, Saudi Arabia are aware that both China and the US are incredibly powerful countries. And, you know, as we've talked about before, they're really not in the place or the position where they want to pick sides or where they want to cause any rifts. Obviously, what happened, deterioration of relations in 2018, you know, between Saudi and the US wasn't great. And that was a big shock. And I think even the Saudi officials were like, okay, this is, let's take a step back, reset, and really focus on what our foreign policy is. Another important turning point for middle powers was looking at, you know, Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And Russia, which I don't think you could consider a middle power at the point of invasion, you know, they were really impacted by Western countries' condemnation of their actions and sanctions as well. And that is, you know, really hit the Russian economy hard. So for Saudi Arabia, that's incredibly important because, you know, I've been emphasizing throughout this podcast episode that Saudi's grand strategy is its economy. And I think Russia's invasion also proves that, like, if you're antagonizing a US partner or ally, you know, you're not just antagonizing that particular country like Ukraine, for example. And if you're causing rifts with the US, you're not just causing rifts with the US, you're causing rifts with all of the US allies and partners.
I want to highlight the fact that I have not heard that narrative before about Saudi's view of the Russia-Ukraine war. I think that we've all been speaking about the importance of a strong support for Ukraine, a strong response to Ukraine, both to deter Russian aggression, but also to dissuade China from thinking that, you know, territorial aggression is a way to achieve your political goals. And yet I have not heard that there are aspiring great powers in their own regions that have taken a similar lesson. So I appreciate you highlighting that for us. One last question is actually on that score. How do you think that Saudi Arabia views the bilateral relationship that it has with Beijing and the Chinese?
Again, for Saudi Arabia, it's really economic. It is, again, part of their grand strategy.
And obviously, China has, through the Belt and Road and other initiatives, you know, financing for infrastructure. So are we saying that Saudi sees China as a way to diversify the economy according to Vision 2030 to then supplement Saudi's own economic power in the region?
Yeah, absolutely. That is a very good summary of it, really, because China is key to that, really. China has a real monopoly over certain critical minerals, with, you know, domestically and also with the, you know, mining companies abroad. You know, Saudi recognizes that, and you need those critical minerals to then build on green energy initiatives. So Saudi Arabia is, you know, they're not naive to that. They're fully aware of that they will need China in the future, and they need them right now as well.
Really appreciate you unpacking some of the incentives and the drivers of Saudi foreign policy in a way that most folks don't get a chance to hear. So thanks, Katie.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for a great interview, Gareth. That was so interesting, particularly the two points she made, as you said in the introduction, about the economic priorities of Saudi Arabia, but also the point about Ukraine and the alliance between the U.S. and its European allies, really as a deterrent for nations such as Saudi Arabia, which might not as often be on our radar, you know, in terms of who we're deterring.
That it's interesting because we've studied how nations like China, for example, are viewing the war in Ukraine and the response of the West, and yet I think her point is that you know, these middle powers, right, which are playing this, you know, trying not to be forced to choose between a U.S.-led international system mm-hmm. and a Chinese analog to that international system, right, through BRICS and other forms that, that they are attempting to propagate. I don't think that we, I think we have underestimated what a United West signal has been received in some of these middle powers. And so I thought it was an interesting level of analysis that she brought to bear in that regard.
Absolutely. And the peace deal with Saudi Arabia was also at least part of the international community's explanation of the October 7th attack as sort of a motivating factor for Hamas to launch an attack at this time. So to know that there are ties between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia still is, I mean, dare I say it, a little bit optimistic.
Well, and you saw the statement, actually, so after my conversation with Katie, the White House released a statement saying that Saudi Arabia was apparently still interested in the overarching deal, which would bring recognition yeah. of Israel with some security guarantees for Saudi Arabia from the U.S. And so, I mean, obviously, the conflict between Israel and Hamas continues, and we'll have to see where that ends up. But I think you're right. It requires Hamas to rethink its political goals for the conflict. If one of the elements that people suspect is the reason why they attacked, as you said, seems to not be successful.
Exactly. Yeah.
But speaking of Russia-Ukraine.
Yes.
You have a really exciting conversation with a very interesting voice. Do you want to tell us about it?
I do. Well, my story today is essentially an update on the current situation in Ukraine, particularly some quite disturbing news about the Russian leadership in the war. Mm. Obviously, the world is focused a lot on the war in Gaza and the Middle East in general. But while this has been happening the last few weeks, Russian forces have really increased tremendous pressure on Ukraine and the counteroffensive that Ukraine is currently conducting in the eastern part of Ukraine. And there are a few noticeable things happening in Ukraine right now that not only deserve to be mentioned, but also possibly have more ties to the Israel-Hamas war than we immediately think. So I thought it would be interesting today to talk about. And I am very, very happy and delighted that today my guest is Ukrainian reporter Veronika Milkozorova, who has covered a lot of the topics that I'm interested in these last few weeks. She's a prominent Ukrainian journalist based in Kyiv. She currently works for Politico, but she's written for everybody from the New York Times, Atlantic, NBC, Vice, you name it. I'm very pleased to be able to sit down with Veronika and talk about these topics. Do you want to hear what she has to say?
I can't wait.
I want to say welcome so much to SSP Weekly, Veronika Milkozorova. First of all, would you like to just briefly introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you so much for having me. My name is Veronika Milkozorova, and I'm a reporter for Politico Europe. I'm in Kyiv, and I'm covering Ukraine and Russia's invasion of Ukraine from here.
We're very happy to have you on to talk about the recent news from Ukraine and some of the things that you've covered in your articles these last few weeks. So my first question is about, after the attack in Israel, a lot of attention in the West is currently being devoted to the conflict between Israel and Hamas. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, in your opinion, how the Russians and President Putin is maneuvering to take advantage of this political situation, whether you see that in the Ukraine conflict right now.
Of course I do. I don't understand the Western leaders' approach to both wars as some separate issues, because if you check the alliances that are there, you can see that Kremlin is supporting Hamas. Even Ukrainian intelligence, military intelligence is saying so. And many Ukrainians who live in Kyiv, including me, when the October 7 attack happened, we felt a very strong feeling of deja vu, because Russians started invading Ukraine with the same tactics. Many missiles barraging all the objects, all the cities at once, while army, in our case it was Russian army, is attacking from several fronts at once, breaking the borders, killing like in a terrorist way. Mm-hmm. And also the some videos of Hamas using the drones, the commercial drones, like Mavic, this like different DJI, it's a Chinese production company that is a leader of leader manufacturer of drones in the world. Hamas was using the same tactics when they were bombing the Jewish tanks Merkavas, using these drones to drop the shells inside the tank. It was like definitely taken from Russian war against Ukraine.
I noticed in one of your articles, you cited a statement from a representative of Ukraine's military intelligence directorate talking about the use of drones and where Hamas has learned to use these drones. Could you elaborate a little bit on that quote and what that means?
Yes, so I talked to Andriy Chernyak, who is one of the one of two talkative Ukraine's military intelligence officials, and he basically told me that, yeah, we know that they trained them because only we and Russians know how to do that so good. And we definitely, I mean, he said we, like Ukrainians definitely did not teach them. So even if Russians did not train them directly, Hamas is a fast learner. And our drone community that I also talked to, it's like we have about a dozen drone operator schools in Ukraine right now who is teaching to fly different kinds of drones for the war front. And they told me that also that they think that Russians trained Hamas, because for example, a person like me cannot learn this technique only like by watching a YouTube video or so. The simple technique of dropping a shell on a moving vehicle or a tank, it takes like 7 days to learn that. If you're piloting an FPV drone, which is a first person view drone, armed with an explosive device on it, it takes like 20 days to learn. So you do have to have an instructor showing you that.
Yeah, so there's a level of expertise and training that's required. In some of your recent coverage, you highlighted instances of Russian soldiers being executed by their own for insubordination. I'm curious, first of all, in your thoughts about that, whether this is a recurring phenomenon or whether you think it indicates something new and, yeah, what this means.
I think that in the second year of war, both Russians and Ukrainians are pretty tired and exhausted. Mm-hmm. And for the Kremlin, it is much, much harder to motivate Russia's fascism against us when it's not based on any material gains or resources they are grabbing and stealing from us. So yes, more and more Russians are started and Russian soldiers' families started recording videos appealing to their Tsar Vladimir Putin to save them from the front, where they are forced to go like armed with just Kalashnikovs against Ukrainian artillery. And it seems that the whole ideology Putin has built of Russians being ready to die, like their grandpas were dying on the World War II fighting Nazism, it's not working. So Putin and his forces returned to other old Soviet tactics, which is called Zagrad Otryad, which is basically means Soviets were sending a group of troops, usually parts of the special unit called NKVD, which is special forces. And their main goal was to check for soldiers that refused to go and attack and returned and flee from the front and shoot them. As cowards, as traitors, as like any other excuse they could come up with. It is reported that, and British intelligence, British Defense Ministry, not us, reported that some of the units of Russian army commanders started executing soldiers for inobedience, because soldiers are more and more asking questions about why do they fight, what are the goals, and the goals of your granddads were fighting Nazism and were fighting for the motherland, so you also have to fight, to go and fight for the motherland and die for the motherland. It doesn't work anymore. So yeah, they turn to violence against their own.
Yeah, of course, it's always extremely difficult to navigate Russian propaganda and politics and how they're actually doing on the battlefield and how far along they are with their strategic goals. But it certainly, from our perspective, indicates that they really have reached a new level of desperation. I want to return a little bit to the US politics, particularly the Ukrainian perception and perspective on them. Unfortunately, the war in Ukraine has become less and less of a focus, particularly for the Republican Party here in the US. Despite, of course, the Biden administration firmly supporting the war, I am curious to how the reactions are in Ukraine right now to that, and what is the administration doing in Ukraine to counter the fatigue or less focus that there is on the Ukrainian war right now?
I will start with the Ukrainian administration. Just today, I talked to some sources there, and I would say they are pretty shocked and desperate, because they didn't understand that somebody can get used to such a scale of violence that Russians are committing here, that people would not want to support anymore just because Ukrainians here are dying, especially now when we see a lot more Gazans are dying in a lot less time frame. And I would say that they are desperately trying to find the key to Republicans who are pretty skeptical about Ukraine. It seems that Ukraine is so far away that the United States leaders do not understand that basically Ukrainian war is not about Ukraine, as well as Israeli-Palestinian war and how it's being used by those who want to change the US on the first place in the world is used. Because now we have two bloody wars where from one side you have the United States and its allies, which is historically Europe is being dependent on the US when it comes to weapons, NATO, and security. And you have Ukraine, which is, we are corrupt, but we're still the only chaotic democracy in the region that is left. Maybe Poland now will be on the right path after their wonderful voting, but it's not clear yet where they're going. But Ukraine is still can be a success story for the US old politics of spreading the democracy and its influence through making people live better. However, US is not that strong anymore, it seems, because US is very divided by very strange internal politics, which we in Europe not quite get how such a strong country can be so polarized by the facts that are either basic human rights or basic common sense, I would say. When the US is trembling, all the world is trembling, because we have either the US as the main policeman of the world, or we have China, Russia, and Iran. And US is still the best choice among all of those. So yeah, we are pretty terrified by the fact that the US still thinks that it's unbeatable.
You mentioned that there's a recognition both from the Russian side and also from the Ukrainian side that aid is really running out and help from Western allies is running out. I guess my last question is whether you think there's anything in this conflict that is not being highlighted enough to global media or the international community, whether there's anything that you would like to highlight that's not getting enough attention.
Yes, I think that, first of all, Ukraine is a success story still. People should have longer memory. I know it's hard when there's like Twitter, all the news cycle, blah, blah, blah. But still, if you judge Ukraine, you should remember that a year ago, airlines were leaving us, journalists were leaving us, embassies were leaving us because people were sure Ukraine would fall in days. We managed to push Russians back from Kyiv. We managed to show the world that all the narratives Russians were pushing all of this time, that we are the same as Russians, we will not fight, we are not worthy of help or aid, or just like we are a failed state, that those all narratives are false. We managed to build a democracy. Maybe it is not an advanced democracy, but it has all the principles of personal responsibility, of unity, of taking risks to do the right job. We criticized our president during war, and he had to deal with it. We managed to break the narratives, even though we had no money. We are a poor nation in comparison to Russia. Mm-hmm. Because Russians, they finance their propaganda, Russia Today, it's like billions and billions of dollars for propaganda. Mm-hmm. And we really want people to remember not only bad things about our corruption or lack of progress in the counteroffensive that everyone wanted and waited, but also remember that this is not only our war, this is the war of the Western democratic world against authoritarians. And if authoritarians win, your local authoritarians that you have and that might become president will also win. And that's going to be a tragedy. Hmm.
Very well said. And I think that's a good way to end this interview, is to remember that Ukraine certainly is a success in the grand scheme of things. Veronica, I want to say thank you so much for being a guest on SSP Weekly. We really appreciate your time and your expertise. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, Miriam, I appreciate you highlighting Ukraine as one of the stories this week. I mean, obviously, we're talking about Israel and Hamas. That's been a priority conversation in Congress in terms of aid funding. And yet we cannot forget about this conflict in Ukraine. I actually think the narrative over the last few weeks has changed. You know, I think there was a lot of optimism during the Ukrainian offensive because of how quickly they captured cities in the Northeast and kind of their initial counteroffensive. I think there's a recognition now about the criticality of U.S. aid, mm-hmm. and an understanding that without further aid packages, this could become a long-term stalemate or worse.
Yeah. I mean, the war has entered its 21st month, Jeez. Right? Yeah, and that, and so we're far past the point where, unfortunately, wars sort of lose their relevance in media coverage and sort of international attention. And so the Israel-Hamas, very dramatic attack, obviously, just catapulted that. I will say what I like about what Veronica writes is also how aware she is of exactly that, aware she is of the lack of focus and why we tend to lack this focus. And so what I really think is cool is how she ties together the situation in Ukraine right now and the lessons learned from other conflicts and how this relates to current conflicts such as the Israel-Hamas attack. And it actually reminded me of an interview you and I did with another guest here on the podcast, which will be released next week, which of course was our conversation with John Antel, analyst and retired army colonel who just has released his new book. I won't go into too much detail because the episode of course is upcoming, but some of the analysis that he made really resonated with what Veronica is saying, mm-hmm. right? Especially the use of drones. So some very current and important lessons are being learned, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting. I was reading some analysis about the latest in the drone element of the conflict, which mm-hmm. obviously you and in your conversation cover. And, I mean, Russia and Ukraine are using what's known as wedding drones, mm-hmm. right? Because they're used to film weddings.
Yeah.
You know, and so they're, as the aid has become shaky and as the kind of conventional platforms that we've been providing continue to flow in, they've had to make do with these Band-Aid solutions. And it's actually, it's fascinating how they've used some of these. I mean, you know, that I think a wedding drone is in the thousands of dollars versus the millions.
Yeah, Veronica wrote an article about it where I think she compared, she explains how a $400 drone can take out a $2 million tank.
Yeah. Right?
And it's these FPV drones, first-person view drones, that are being used, that were used originally, or I think they were introduced or really had a lot of effect for the first time in the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict, as John Antel also mentions in our future episode. And also by Hamas. It was an important part of Hamas's attack when they were starting out in the morning of October 7th. So really fascinating and really just proves that, of course, Ukraine should not be forgotten, but down to very tactical details, the conflict keeps being relegated. I was really happy to get the journalistic angle of the conflict because Veronica is obviously one of the most prominent reporters covering really current events and breaking news. So I really appreciate that she took the time to sit down with me.
Yeah, thank you to both of our guests and have a great weekend, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Bye.